You can now find all of C-SPAN's nonfiction-focused podcasts in one place, the C-SPAN Bookshelf feed. Follow now, and you'll get all of C-SPAN's podcasts that are nonfiction book-related every week. I'm Shannon.
And I'm Rachel. And as part of the podcast team here at C-SPAN, we wanted to make it easy for our nonfiction book lovers to access all of our offerings in one place.
Hear from authors like Kidada Williams on her book, I Saw Death Coming, Joan Biskubic and her latest, Nine Black Robes, or Neil King, who shared his walking journey from D.C. to New York City in his book, American Ramble.
Featured programs will include Book Notes Plus, Q&A, Afterwards, and About Books. You can follow the C-SPAN Bookshelf feed wherever you get your podcasts.
In this weekend episode, three segments from this week's Washington Journal program on C-SPAN. First, a discussion about Secretary of State Antony Blinken's trip to China with Elbridge Colby, co-founder of the Marathon Initiative and a former Trump administration defense official. Next, Guttmacher Institute's Kelly Baden looks at how states have been impacted since the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Plus, University of Texas at Austin's Peniel Joseph on the significance of the recently celebrated Juneteenth holiday. Now, the Marathon Initiative's Elbridge Colby on the recent visit to China by Secretary of State Antony Blinken and what he thought the trip produced.
Mr. Colby, good morning to you. This is one of the headlines from today's Washington Post about Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to China, that meeting with Xi Jinping from earlier this week. Blinken's visit to China appears to dial back tensions. Do you share that assessment?
Not really. And great to be with you, John. Always a pleasure to be on Washington Journal. I would say that it's largely optical at this point. I mean, just this morning, actually, it's been reported that the president referred to Xi Jinping as a dictator, I think, in a fundraiser in California. And that led to an excoriation by the Chinese foreign ministry. So what we've seen was, I would say, some civility or kind of cordiality in Secretary Blinken's meeting. But I don't think we've seen any kind of structural change here. We haven't seen any fundamental change at all from the Chinese side. In fact, I think in the news this morning, it was reported the Chinese are stepping up bomber missions around Taiwan. Of course, there's the news about the listening post, possibly a military facility in Cuba, et cetera. So, you know, I think calling it a thaw is aspirational on the part of the administration and certainly yet to be demonstrated. I'm very, very skeptical about it.
Why does China and Xi Jinping take this meeting?
Well, I think their reasons for wanting to possibly have a kind of tactical pause, I'd stress that I don't think we see any evidence of a fundamental change in Xi Jinping's sort of long-term strategic orientation or that of the People's Republic of China. In fact, he had a senior National Security Commission meeting, I'd say, I think about a week or two ago, where he stressed the readiness, the need for the Chinese government to be ready for extreme scenarios and so forth and so on. There's an article in the Financial Times about how they're ramping up their defense industrial base, et cetera. So we've seen no change. I think the stress on China right now, particularly coming out of COVID and some of the less than stellar, sort of less than that they would like economic returns, is China's looking for a little bit of relenting, I would say, tactically on the economic front. And they are concerned, very concerned, about some of the economic sanctions that have happened, but also that are potentially on the table. But I also fear my skepticism is also about the merits of this meeting. I'm quite concerned. Xi Jinping said something to Secretary Blinken or about Secretary Blinken to the effect of, there have been very good agreements and this is very good, or something. You've made agreements. And it wasn't quite clear what was agreed and what potentially not only has been offered by the administration, but has been held back by the administration as part of this attempt, because there have been discussions of follow-on meetings by people in the administration are usually seen as more pro, I would say, accommodation towards China. John Kerry, Secretary Kerry, Secretary Yellen, Secretary Raimondo. So that's quite disturbing. And there have been reports that the administration, for instance, may be either slow rolling and or kind of hollowing out or watering down an executive order on outward bound investment screening. So this is where I think a lot of the real concern comes from. I'm all for talking to the Chinese. That's fine. But we shouldn't be deluded. I was in Singapore for the Shangri-La dialogue. The defense minister there was very confident, quite, I would say, assertive, including on the Taiwan issue. And while we were there, the Chinese cut off an American vessel transiting the Taiwan Strait. And I think the most important point about that, not that it just happened, but the U.S. vessel was transiting with a Canadian vessel. The Chinese did not do that to the Canadian vessel. They did it to the American vessel, which was, I think, designed to show everybody they're not intimidated and they're prepared to take risk and put that risk on the Americans. And what I fear is that we are allowing that to sort of, we're the ones who are supposed to right the boat that they've been shaking.
The Secretary of State was on CBS News, and he was talking about the importance of taking these kinds of meetings to lower the tension, as you were talking about. This is some of what he had to say.
It's a work in progress. This is something that we need to do in the interests of both of our countries. That is, not only to establish and reestablish and strengthen lines of communication across our government, which we have done, starting with this trip, and I believe visits to follow by a number of my colleagues and then Chinese officials coming to the United States, usually important if we're going to responsibly manage the relationship, if we're going to communicate clearly and try to avoid the competition that we have veering into conflict. But an aspect of that that really is important is military to military. Mm-hmm. We don't have an agreement on that yet. It's something we're going to keep working. I made very clear to our Chinese counterparts the importance that we attach to that, something that is also profoundly in their interest, because again, we both agree that we want to, at the very least, make sure that we don't inadvertently have a conflict because of miscommunication, because of misunderstanding.
Secretary of State on CBS News on Monday. He was talking about visits to follow. What would you be looking for on a visit to follow that would signify some sort of more thawing here?
Well, I'm actually genuinely perplexed, John, I have to confess, because if what we're talking about is merely this sort of having discussions, for instance, the military to military communication, obviously that has some utility. But there's in human history, as far as I know, there's never been a war that started by accident. During the Cold War, but the Chinese actually and the Soviets also shot down American aircraft. The Chinese brought down the EP-3 20 years ago. If we don't want to have a war, we're not going to have a war. So on both sides, I don't mean to be flippant about that. I think the danger is very real, but it's not going to happen by accident. So if Secretary Blinken is talking about just the need to have discussions that really aren't going to address the structural realities, then I don't understand why it's so important. I mean, look, it's valuable, but the Chinese actually probably are more right. They're the ones saying, look, there are substantive issues. Their views are very different. They blame us. What worries me is that they actually are pursuing something beyond just having channels of communication, going back to the kind of policy that was typical during the Obama administration, in which there was a dialogue for dialogue's sake, in which the administration's approach is competing while cooperating, which the Chinese have roundly rejected and actually doesn't really make any sense, where the administration is going to try with people like Secretary Kerry to talk about climate and cooperate on climate. The reality is, and the way the Chinese see it, is that this is a deep structural rivalry where economics is critical to it. And the administration's semiconductor and other sanctions are obviously designed in that direction, and in my view are commendable, though they need to be coupled with much more on the military front. But I'm genuinely confused, and I imagine if I'm confused, many other people are. And what I fear is that this is going to chill and inhibit the measures that are needed within the government and among our allies to negotiate from a position of strength.
That was Elbridge Colby from the Marathon Initiative. Next, Kelly Baden of the Guttmacher Institute joined the program to discuss how abortion policy on the state level has been affected since the overturn of Roe v. Wade.
On the homepage, a link to this report, The State of Abortion Policy, The Landscape, 1 year post Roe v. Wade. Kelly Baden, one of the authors of that report. This is the lead paragraph. 1 year after the United States Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs v. Jackson to overturn Roe v. Wade, the status of abortion rights in many states is dismal, and complex legal questions continue to create chaos and confusion. You write, there's also bright spots that can chart a pathway to more state and federal protections for abortion. Start first on the dismal aspect. What would you describe as dismal?
Absolutely. Well, what I would describe as dismal is the current reality, which is that 19 million women of reproductive age right now live in a state that has banned abortion or severely restricted it with an early abortion ban such as Georgia. I think importantly, opponents of abortion have spent the last 50 years since Roe v. Wade was decided trying to overturn it, and in the meantime, greatly restricting abortion in whatever way they could at the state level, thousands of bills of laws. And so several of those were what we call trigger bans, which were bans on abortion intended to go into effect at the state level as soon as the Supreme Court allowed them to do so. And so a year ago, right after the Dobbs decision, 9 states had abortion bans go into effect immediately or soon after. And since then, it's just gotten worse. We have 13 states that have fully banned abortion, one where abortion is unavailable due to, again, legal complexity and chaos, which I think is the key word, and then a series of other abortion restrictions and bans tied up in the courts or being considered or passed by states this year.
An interactive map on guttmacher.org where you can look at the state of abortion access in this country. The darkest red there, the states that have the most restrictive access, and those are mostly the states with those trigger laws. So explain what's happening in those darkest red states.
Right. So those are states that have completely banned abortion with very limited exceptions. For example, they might have an exception for a pregnancy that resulted from sexual assault or that threatens a woman's health or life. But we know that those kinds of exceptions are very difficult to access in practice. They really exist mostly in name only. And so you can see looking at that map and thinking about, you know, what we know about state legislatures and their political climates, that there's really an entire region of the country where there is no legal abortion access, that whole southeast region, which means that for the past year, someone in Louisiana, for example, who wants or needs an abortion has had to figure out how to navigate across multiple state lines to get a legal abortion in a state where it is still allowed in a clinic. And so it's a really difficult, challenging situation that requires you to have money, childcare, time off work, and an ability to navigate all of those barriers to get to legal abortion care.
Coming back to that map, three states on that map you describe as very restrictive, sort of the next most restrictive category, the orange states here, Georgia, Nebraska, Arizona. Why do you describe that as very restrictive?
So those are the states that have not fully banned abortion, but have enacted bans on abortion early in pregnancy. So that creates additional challenges, not only, again, for people in that state, but for all of those people from the neighboring states who don't have a legal abortion and are trying to get their care in those states. So Georgia, as I mentioned, has a very early ban on abortion in pregnancy at about 6 weeks, which means that many people might not even know they're pregnant by then. And then by the time they're able to get the appointment, get the money, get the time off work, they might not be able to access abortion in that state. Similarly, Nebraska made a lot of news this year by trying to enact a similar 6-week abortion ban. It failed, but they did end up getting a ban on abortion at 12 weeks attached to a ban on gender-affirming care as well. So really looking at how I think that story tells us that bans on abortion and bans on gender-affirming care are really kind of two sides of the same coin. And I think Nebraska illustrates that really well.
Which brings up what you talked about in the first paragraph of that report, the complex legal questions that are creating chaos and confusion, as you describe it. What's an example of that?
I think Wisconsin is a good example. That is that state, that 14th state, where we say abortion is not legally banned per se, but it's the legal questions are complicated enough that folks have chosen not to provide abortion care there. And so abortion is unavailable. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's very similar to operating under a climate of an actual abortion ban.
What's a preemption law?
A preemption law is when a state tells cities or localities in that state what they can or can't do. It kind of says that the state has precedence over attempts by a city or county to do something. And I think where we're seeing that relate to abortion this year is with the series of county commissions or city councils who have tried to take action. If they're, for example, a blue state or a blue city in a red state and have tried to move to somehow protect abortion rights or access within their community. And the states have moved to kind of block that using this concept of preemption.
Why is Oregon the one state on this map that you list as the most protective of abortion access?
Well, Oregon just checks a lot of boxes in terms of good proactive policies. It was an early adopter of a bill called the Reproductive Health Equity Act, which really recognized that not only is legality of abortion important, but your ability to pay for it, especially via insurance coverage, especially if you're somebody who qualifies for public insurance coverage, is a big part of that equation. And so they've been able to enact a lot of laws, again, to not just focus on legality, but expand access. And there are many other states on that map that have done really wonderful things that we could talk about, and I think really set up a series of recommendations for other states to consider.
That was Guttmacher Institute's Kelly Baden. Finally, University of Texas at Austin's Peniel Joseph discusses the importance of the federally recognized Juneteenth holiday.
Peniel Joseph, today is Juneteenth. Remind our viewers why we call it Juneteenth and its significance.
Well, Juneteenth refers to the June 19th, 1865 dissemination of General Order Number 3 by Major General Gordon Granger, who had arrived in the port of Galveston 2 days earlier with 2,000 Union troops to really support the dissemination of freedom, because there were still battles being fought after the surrender of General Robert E. Lee to Ulysses S. Grant in April of 1865 at the Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia, there were still battles being fought as late as May of 1865 and June of 1865 in a state like Texas. Texas is a stronghold of a dying Confederacy. And so what General Order Number 3 says is that, one, there's going to be absolute equality between blacks and whites in terms of property rights and civil rights. Number 2, it says that the free women and men should stay on their plantations and really engage in labor contracts with those who formerly presumed to own them. And number 3, it says black folks should not try to go to military camps or engage in any kind of idleness. In many ways, black people looked to number 1 in that idea of absolute equality between blacks and whites. And really, there were some people throughout the state of Texas who in Galveston who fled plantations then, who did go to military headquarters where you could get provisions, food, find out about your family. And there were others who stayed, but certainly celebrations happened that day. But there was also tragedies that happened that day. We have to remember Major General Gordon Granger, who takes over a villa in Galveston. He's surrounded by a very vengeful and fearful and anxious prone white society that's decaying. And so they were very, very fearful of what this idea of absolute equality meant. But certainly by 1866, black people are formally celebrating Juneteenth as Emancipation Day, as Freedom Day, as really the true meaning of American democracy. And those celebrations are going to continue to take place across the state of Texas. And we'll see black folks who are buying land in Houston, Jack Yates and Reverend Elias Dibble, and Richard Allen, Richard Brock, they buy 10 acres of land, which is now Emancipation Park. So Juneteenth becomes a way to celebrate, commemorate, but also there's something that's very much entrepreneurial about Juneteenth, about organizing black folks, organizing black businesses, organizing the black vote. This is all connected to this idea of black citizenship and dignity. And so Juneteenth becomes basically the nation's real Independence Day, because before Juneteenth, as Frederick Douglass had said in his very famous 1852 address in Rochester, New York, which has come to be known as, what to the slave is the 4th of July. The 4th of July made a mockery of freedom. It made a mockery of dignity. It made a mockery of democracy because it was celebrated amidst not only the marginalization of women, settler colonialism against indigenous people, the mistreatment of Chinese and Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, mistreatment of people who are from Mexico and from Spanish-speaking countries, but because of antebellum slavery, racial slavery.
What does the Juneteenth federal holiday do? What role does it play toward inclusiveness of democracy?
Well, I think it's unbelievably important. Juneteenth is the first federal holiday since the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. federal holiday in 1983. And it's the first time the United States of America has acknowledged its original sin of racial slavery. So in a lot of ways, even before you can have an inclusive democracy, you have to have a shared truth about that democracy. And that's the battle. Even when Juneteenth first unfolded in 1865, we've been engaged in an almost 160-year narrative war between those who are supporters of multiracial democracy, who I've called Reconstructionists, and those who are supporters and advocates of the lost cause and white supremacy and anti-black racism and the racial caste system, who are really redemptionists. And so what Juneteenth provides is it inroads to build a consensus around the origin stories of the country. I mean, there was an earlier caller who was saying that, racial slavery is something the United States has ended. This was British and the Spanish and the French is fault. That kind of, and then the person saying they have academic credentials, those kinds of things are ridiculous, right? And they continue the falsehoods and the mythology America is one of the deepest, biggest innovators of racial slavery globally, right? America is one of the biggest and deepest innovators of Jim Crow and white supremacy globally. We wanted to export those folks who were part of the Confederate States of America, wanted to create a global slave empire that stretched from the Mexicos to the Central and South Americas. They wanted to annex and colonize Mexico and Brazil and Central America. So, you know, part of what we're trying to do, I think, with Juneteenth is really tell the origin story of the United States. But we can tell that story where we look at the bitter and the beautiful parts of the struggle for dignity and citizenship without constantly having to lie to ourselves and about ourselves. And the lie is so big, people are willing to go to war and commit acts of violence and great brutality in the name of this lie.
That was Peniel Joseph from the University of Texas. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.